Empower Radio presents Out of the Fog. Join intuitive guide and spiritual teacher Karen Hager for lively, positive conversation with light workers, healers, and dynamic wisdom keepers. Get ready for inspiration and connection. This is Out of the Fog on Empower Radio. Here's your host, Karen Hager.
Hello and welcome to Out of the Fog. I'm Karen Hager. Each week at this time, we gather for spiritual conversation and enlightening guests, and I am glad you're here. Time and distance are no barrier to energy, and that means no matter when you're listening, no matter how you found us, you are here for a reason. And I hope something in the next hour lights you up and helps you move forward. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to trade in the modern world of technology and globalization and live off the grid? Well, my guest on today's show is Molly Caro May, and she's here to share her story of finding what home really means to her. In her new book, The Map of Enough, she explores how we establish roots, how we experience a sense of place, and can discover the kind of life that we want to lead. Are you ready to meet her? Molly Caro May is a graduate of Middlebury College and has worked as a teacher, artist model, apple and cherry picker, lab assistant to a clinical herbalist, barista in a seaside town, opera caterer, field assistant to a frog biologist, conservation program developer, mentor to at-risk teenagers, vegetable farmer, and in the editorial department of a New York-based publisher. She now lives with her husband, daughter, and hound in the Gallatin Valley of Montana. The Map of Enough is her first book. You can find out more about Molly and her work at mollycaromay.com. Molly, welcome to Out of the Fog.
Thank you so much, Karen. Such a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're very welcome. You have quite a list of accomplishments there. I wonder what a frog biologist does. Do you mind just sharing that? A field assistant to a frog, is that catching the frogs or what is that?
There was a woman I worked, helped in New Zealand. She studied frogs and studied them on a small island. So I went with her, and in the middle of the night we would crawl along these little pathways looking for frogs and counting the digits on their fingers, or however many fingers they had on their hands for some reason. So I was her assistant. That's what we did.
So you're a frog digit counter as well as your many other,
exactly.
So your many other accomplishments. Exactly. Now in the book, The Map of Enough, you spend some time kind of letting us know about your childhood, and you declared yourself at an early age to be a nomad. And I wonder if you can share with the listeners a little bit about your childhood. How was it different than what most of us have experienced?
Well, I grew up moving every 2 or 3 years, and we were living mostly abroad. So I was born in Australia, and then I moved to the Dominican Republic, and then Spain, and then Mexico. And then eventually we moved to the States and sort of continued that pattern of moving. But this was very familiar for me because my father had grown up that way, and his father had grown up that way as well, living abroad. And I went to international schools with children who were moving also every 2 or 3 years. So nothing was strange for me about that experience. In fact, it was really energizing, and I really liked it as a young person. But when I moved to the States, I came to understand how, you know, quote, exotic that was to American kids and girls in particular who had lived in one place their whole life. So I started to sort of identify myself, you know, within and without that.
Hmm. And there's that sense of identifying yourself as I'm the girl who never stays put. I'm the free girl, right? I go where I want, and I'm exotic. I'm from nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the freedom with that is a big piece. And I used to ask my mother, you know, are we nomads? And she would say, no, we're not nomads. And I would say, well, then what are we? You know, what are we? Because I need a definition for this. Hmm. And, you know, it's taken me a while to really understand that in the context of everything else.
I saw a really terrible film, and I was, before we came on the air, I was Googling like mad, and I can't find the film. It may be because it's been deservedly forgotten, but it was a pseudo-documentary about a group of people making a really terrible Bible movie in the middle of Los Angeles in the summer, and it was a horrible movie, and part of the film was following this young production assistant, and they would send him out to get things, and he would get lost every time and just never come back. So one time, on one of these trips, the camera goes with him in the car, and he's driving around endlessly, and the camera person says, well, why can't you find anything? And the guy says, oh no, I've got it all under control. I'm making my own map of LA. And he shows this piece of paper, and it's just like little squiggles, and it'll say like studio over here, and then there'll be kind of a squiggly line. It'll say dead end, or, you know, grocery store. And there's that sense when we're looking for definition, we're building our own, we're kind of making our own map of LA, right? Here are the places I can count on. Here are the things I know are there. And then all the delight about the spaces that are in between.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, I titled the book, The Map of Enough. Really for that reason, because maps have always been a big part of my sensory experience as a child and adult. I really like paging through maps and sort of poring over them. But also, exactly what you said, this idea of creating our own maps about who we are and about the places we live in, but really about who we are in those places. And we all do this on some level. But part of my exploration in the book and in real life was why was I so attached to this identity, and what did it allow me to sort of hide from? Because it's very easy to tell people, oh, I grew up in all these exotic places and I'm from nowhere. And that gets a response right away, of course. And but what's behind that? You know, who's the person behind all of that also is a big question I had and still have.
And it's that difference, too. If I say I'm from nowhere and everywhere and I've lived all over the world, people might go, oh, that's really neat. Oh, tell us some stories. Ooh. But it also, there's a, at least I sense from the book, there's an emptiness behind that, right? That after a while, that kind of the approval of other people doesn't fill that space.
No, exactly. And, you know, part of being... I moved to Montana right before I turned 30 years old, and part of that is life stage, I think, but I was starting to ask those questions about, you know, what is this going to look like for me? Am I going to move every 2 or 3 years? And I have that impulse in my body. I feel it in my body, this desire for newness and what's next. But at the same time, I had this urge to really know something about anything, about any place, instead of knowing a little bit about a lot of places. And, you know, that coincided with knowing something more about myself, obviously, going, you know, having a sort of sending a taproot down in myself.
That's a very powerful image, that idea of that taproot going down and down and seeking center. That's a beautiful image. Why don't you let us know a little bit of the backstory about where you were before you came to the land in Montana, and then how you ended up there?
My husband Chris and I were living in New York City. We've been there for 3 years. It wasn't a place we wanted to stay forever, but we, you know, we liked our time there, and then we knew it was time to move on. So we were sitting in our kitchen, in our tiny little kitchen, and thinking, where can we go? We have to go somewhere where we can live rent-free, because we are both about to leave our jobs and really wanted to pursue. I wanted to pursue writing. He wanted to pursue his furniture design. And we wanted to be in a natural environment again. We'd lived in places like that before. And so we were sort of throwing darts at where we could go. We knew we wanted to stay in the U.S. for a little bit. And my family at the time, and still does, obviously, own this piece of land in Montana. We'd both been there once, I think. I'd been there maybe twice, but we didn't really have any connection to it, and we didn't know much about it. But it seemed like really our one option, our one true option, was that we could go. There was a little cabin on the land, and we thought, you know, maybe we can caretake the land in exchange for not paying rent, and we can sort of pitch that to my parents and see what they think. And that's what we decided. And this particular place, this particular town in Montana is a university town. We're 20 minutes outside of it, but it's surrounded by five mountain ranges and feels very wild to me, at least. And so that was our, it was sort of a shot in the dark, and we decided we'll go and we'll see if we stay for, maybe we'll stay for a year, see what it's like, and then move on, you know. And we've been here, I think now this summer will be 5 years. So we didn't envision that or intend that, but that's what ended up happening.
And whose idea was it to build the yurt?
We, when we were falling in love as 20-year-olds, we had always sort of fantasized about a yurt, because Chris is really enthralled with architecture, and I liked the idea of a nomadic structure you could put up and take down. And we like to use our hands and use our bodies, and so we thought, well, we have a little bit of time here. We need a structure to live in that isn't the family cabin. Let's do it. You know, and this could be something that can stay on the land and other people can use it when we're not using it. And it was really a magical thing for us to think about living in a circular space, you know, surrounded by mountains and snowy winter and, you know, wildflowers in the summer and mountain lions and bears and elk and all of that. And so we didn't really have a sense of how long it would take or the difficulty of doing it, but it was really about magic, I think, for us, the sense of magic. And also that we were doing this at a time when most of our friends were in some sort of amazing graduate program or moving, advancing quickly in their careers and buying houses and having children. And we were building a yurt. You know, it was very, at times it felt like the exact perfect thing I wanted to be doing, because it felt different and like I was blowing my own mind. And at other times I felt like, wow, what am I doing? Is this really the smart thing to do, you know?
Well, and especially as winter came in, as I was reading the process, because you did all this, you didn't buy a handy build your own yurt in five easy steps kit. This is all handcrafted and a tremendous amount of manual labor and artistry. But as winter came early, you guys found yourself in a bit of a fix.
We did. It was the middle of December. Well, winter came early in the beginning of October. And so we only had the foundation up barely. And the rest of the time we were plowing through the snow to move, you know, to finish the yurt inside, but also then to move all the pieces up a very steep hill where the yurt was going to be. And so when we ended up putting the last day when we erected it, it was negative 20 something degrees and the wind was blowing and we got waylaid by the wind a bunch of times. And it was, you know, we had our dog with us and he was sort of new to us. So he was wrapped in a down jacket and sort of looking at us like, what kind of life have you brought me into? And we got it up eventually, but it was, you know, I look back on it now and I think I'm almost 35. I look back on it now and I think, wow, we did that. I don't know if I have the energy for that right now, you know, but for some reason that, you know, was challenging, but it was part of the adventure really.
And the yurt is a wonderful metaphor for the bigger picture of your work, of the book, because the yurt is permanent in the sense that the wind doesn't blow it over. It's sturdy. It stays. You create your own environment within it, but it's also portable. You can take it down and move it. So it was a kind of an interesting way for you guys to be halfway. I'm here, but if I need to be somewhere else, I can take it with me.
Exactly. And I think that's part of why at that stage it was okay for me to build it. I did have moments when I was building it where I felt like I needed to flee. I would get in my car and drive to the highway and just drive for a couple exits to feel like I was going somewhere. And, you know, because to dig into the ground and create a foundation, I'd never done anything like that. And it started to feel sort of permanent to me, and that frightened me a little bit. But it is this amazing structure. We have moved it, actually. It's down from the hill now. And well, we might move it again to a different spot on the land. And so, and our original vision for it was that we would live here in it, and then when we were ready to go, we would pack it up, put it in our car, and go. And I don't know if that'll happen, if we'll take it to a different state or a different country, but that whole nomadic part of it was really what drew me towards it. Absolutely.
And it's almost like it made it safe for you to create a foundation, because it was a foundation.
Exactly.
But if you had to, if the mood struck,
exactly,
if we had to flee, if we had to go, if the time was right, I can fold this up and take it.
Exactly. You know, and it's really, one thing I tell people is that it really feels like you're living without a membrane when you're in it. The walls are made of canvas and wood. And so you're in a tent, essentially. It's like a glorified tent. And you hear everything. You hear the wind, you hear the owls, you hear the little critters scurrying by and brushing against the canvas. So that, I think that is part of the magic, is that you are living, or I was living in a tent. And I think that's really unusual. Not many of us have that experience, to do that for a chunk of time. Maybe we do it for a night or two or a weekend, but what ends up happening, or what happened for me, was that I felt incredibly connected to everything around me. And that's almost cliche to say that. You know, what does that really mean, to be connected to everything around me? But the sounds became sort of part of my physical experience, my physical body. And I just feel so grateful to have experienced that.
We put up so many membranes, don't we? We drive, you know, I drove here with the windows up and the air conditioning on and the mm-hmm. CD player on. And we mm-hmm. do so many things on purpose to distance ourselves from mm-hmm. what's happening outside, whether that's mm-hmm. outside our, in our physical being, or what we feel is outside the experience we want to have or what we should be having. That idea of living without that membrane, it sounds fabulous, but it also feels scary to me. Was it, mm-hmm. was there ever a vulnerability about it that was unnerving to you?
I think there are a couple pieces there. I mean, the first is that I was scared by some of the animals. You know, I'd never lived in a place where there were animals that could bite me or eat me, you know, bears and lions, and where you wouldn't want to walk around at night by yourself because you might be mistaken for a deer. You know, I'd never lived in a place like that. So especially in the beginning, I was scared, and I would walk out onto the porch at 3 a.m. to, you know, pee on the snow or something, and really look around, like, is someone watching me? And eventually that became less intense for me. But having the pure disconnect was actually a great relief, especially after living in New York. You know, we had our cell phones worked up in the yurt, but we had flip phones at that point, and it was a whole different thing. So we didn't have any, we couldn't use our computers for much longer than the battery life initially. And so we didn't really have them up there. And, you know, we cooked on a Coleman stove and on our wood stove. And so it was very, it felt very disconnected. And in that way, it felt like I was being given a gift. And I sort of knew at the time, this is unusual. Right now, it's unusual in general, but it wasn't unusual that long ago, but it is now in this time. And I really soaked it up. I wasn't scared. There were 2 weeks that I was by myself in the yurt, and that was a little scary for sure. I was with my dog and Chris was out of town. But it's more that I felt my own, and people say this, I felt my own smallness. Hmm. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a really a good way. I felt I was given that perspective of my own smallness, because every night I would stare up at the huge sky through the skylight, the stars and the moon, and the trees looming, the shadows of the trees coming in, and it gave me this great sense of grounding and sort of a who cares feeling. Mm. I thought everything's okay, not all the time, but things are okay. But you know, initially, when we first moved to Montana, absolutely everything felt vulnerable. It was so quiet. It was, I had not been accustomed to that quiet. So yes.
And even the neighbors who were around you were far away. And so those mm-hmm. community connections that you did make eventually were kind of at your discretion. Will I engage or will I not engage?
Right.
Right? It would have been easy to just stay in the middle of that big piece of land and just get very, very still.
Absolutely. You know, and I will say that when you use the word still, there was a moment or a period of time there where we didn't have much contact, right when we moved into the yurt with many other folks. And I'm not a quiet person by nature. I like to be in community. And I found myself really quieting and becoming almost shy. And almost shy to the point where if we were down in the cabin and someone came to the door, I almost didn't want to answer it, which was really strange for me because I'd never been that sort of person. And I just sort of caved in is the wrong word because that sounds negative, but I sort of rolled in on myself and just wanted to be quiet and with everything. But that did scare me a little bit. You know, what's happening to me? Am I going to be able to be social again? Is this bad? Is it bad to be quiet? You know, that came up a lot.
That just makes me think of your taproot going down. That sometimes it passes through those deep, rich, those dark spaces, and it's quiet in there. As you dig for home there, as you dig for center, it can be very quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I had come to visit you in the yurt while it was up there perched on top of that rise with the wind buffeting it all the time, what was it like inside? What would I have seen? It was a small space, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was 200 square feet and wood floors inside. It's really warm feeling in terms of the glow. If the wood stove was going, we had a tiny wood stove, so flickering fire, canvas walls, but all wood inside of the canvas. So lattice walls and then 60 roof poles that sort of look like jousting poles, the way I describe them, going up to meet a circular skylight. Sort of poking into the circular skylight. And we had a bed there and a desk and a little bench for our kitchenware. That's really it. And then our dog had a bed sort of under the desk. So it was very simple. But in the winter, it felt like it felt like a beating heart. Mm. It would just pulse warmth because it could be negative 10 outside and it could be 90 degrees inside the yurt because of the wood stove and the way it warmed up. Not quickly, but once it did, it was very warm. And then in the summer, we had the door flung open and birds would fly by and even fly in and fly out. And we had the final windows rolled up and everything smelled of sagebrush and wind sort of. So yeah, those are sort of the two modes it existed in.
One very closed in and hunkered down and mm-hmm. kind of all tightly coiled around itself, and the other absolutely wide open and part of the mm-hmm. land. I love that. That's a metaphor for me as I'm listening to you about the ways that we relate to spirit, the way we relate to the divine, mm-hmm. right? Sometimes mm-hmm. tight, wrapping ourselves so tightly around mm-hmm. that, and other times feeling that same divine essence in the wind blowing through us in movement or intuition moving through us. Oh, this is fabulous stuff. When we come back after this short break, Molly, are you willing to read us a little from the book so that people can get a sense of the voice? This is one of the most beautifully written memoirs I think I've ever read, and I'd love for you to share a little bit from the book.
I would love to.
Oh, fantastic. You are listening to Out of the Fog with Karen Hager. My guest is Molly Caromay. We're talking about her story and her new book, The Map is Enough. We'll be right back with Molly after this.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
And I love it. I'm home.
I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
Where I be.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Sassy.
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg.
Ha ha, I win. Whoa! Ah!
Sassy! Johnny fell down the well.
I'm wet.
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl. What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold.
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound health and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on, and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
And now back to Out of the Fog with Karen Hager on Empower Radio, empowerradio.com.
Welcome back to Out of the Fog. I'm Karen Hager, and my guest on today's show is Molly Caromay. Her new book is The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place, and you can find out more about Molly and her work at mollycaromay.com. And I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your feedback on today's show. Does listening to Molly's story spur a desire in you to connect more deeply with your own sense of home? Does it make you wonder how you relate to the physical place that you're in, as well as the spiritual space that you're in? You can always reach me through my website, KarenHager.com, and I welcome your email, your comments about the show. Now, Molly, we talked a little bit about how that sometimes as you were building that foundation for the year, you wanted to flee, you wanted to get out, you just went and drove the highway so there'd be a place to go. There's a shift that comes where you start to feel like you belong there, where you start to feel a connection with the land. Was that shift in the book? It feels like it flows beautifully, but I wonder if it was more difficult than we might think from reading it.
That's a good question. I actually think it was fairly organic in the way it unfolded, but the early period of being on the land, I felt very torn, so excited about what we were doing, so concerned that I was pigeonholing myself and that I felt trapped and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But once we were living in the yurt after we'd finished building it, and once that quieting sort of settled in for me, I still had a lot of questions. I still felt like, is this enough? Is this enough that all I'm doing is living in a yurt right now? That question was very present. But there was this slow seeping into me of the natural world. And, you know, when that happens, and I'd had glimpses of it before as a girl, as an adult, but glimpses. But when that happens over a period of time, suddenly there is a natural, at least for me, a natural sort of settling. And I don't mean necessarily settling in one place, but I mean a sense of settling into something. Like, I am part of this big, amazing thing called the planet, called the natural world, and I'm actually part of it. I'm not separate from it. And that was very comforting to me. So I think just over the course of being surrounded by that natural world, that understanding really came to me in slow drips.
And there's that difference between having to run away from the land and get in the car and drive and drive and drive, to by the time we get to the middle of the book, you're, when there's a decision to make, you go and lie down face down in the grass. And that's such mm-hmm. a difference by being still. All the movement is still within you, but you're not running anymore.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I had been very addicted to running and to, to movement. Because when you move, your brain moves, your heart moves, things move. I still believe in walking. You know, if Chris and I ever have an argument, our sort of deal is that we will go walking and we will talk it out while we are walking, because something happens there. It's a better way to sort of be together. But that said, I was addicted to remaking myself in movement constantly, and not ever pausing long enough to sort of take a breath and say, whoa, okay, what am I sitting with here? What is the feeling I'm sitting with? Let me sit with it instead of running as fast as I can away from it.
Because there's that feeling of what's next, and we're kind of pushed by that, I think, by the way technology's in our lives, by the pressure that we put on ourselves or we feel is being put on us, that we'll do this thing, but we can't even enjoy it. We can't even stop. What's next? What next? What next?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I still have this love-hate relationship with social media and technology for that very reason. I want to be part of, I don't want to distance myself so much that I don't know what's happening for all my friends and my community in terms of that connection. But at the same time, I never feel good ever when I'm using technology. I really don't. I might have a moment of feeling like, oh, it was fun to connect with that person for a second, but it does not fill me in the way I feel filled when I am in person in the flesh with a friend, or when I hike up a steep hill and feel the blood coursing up and down my legs. Those are sensory experiences. I always say to my friends, and it sounds weird, but I say, I want to smell you. Like, I want to go walking with you and smell you. And what I mean is really in the animal sense. I don't want to just sit in a restaurant and have coffee or talk to you over Skype. I want to be with you in the physical body and move together through the landscape, because for me, that's the ultimate connection.
Why are we so scared of that connection, do you think? Mm. Coffee's easier, it's safer, there are more membranes, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that's part of it. It's very raw to be with someone so intimately in sort of the physical space, because it gets right into that intimate emotional space at the same time. You know, I was with a friend the other day, a new friend, and we were talking and she was looking into my eyes and I could see her eyes flashing back and forth as she was looking at me, like really looking into my eyes for something. And at first it was disarming because not many people do that. They sort of look away or they, you know, and she really wasn't. And I thought, wow, this is why this is difficult for us, because intimacy is difficult, you know, even with ourselves.
Hmm. Well, and there are the forms that we feel life should take. I should live in this house. I should drive this car. I should do this and then do this. And then there is that kind of that deep internal movement, that connection that we often miss because we're not. A friend of yours says in the book that you should just listen to the land, let the land talk to you. And we're not listening very much.
Mm-mm. No, because I don't think we want to hear it, to be honest. I think it's hard, and I know it is for me, to pause and listen to the land and mostly to myself. It's much easier to, you know, bop around and deal with a to-do list and drive here and drive there and post something on Facebook. I mean, but ultimately, it just feels so empty, and I think people feel that. I don't know. I feel it so much, but part of me starts to wonder, are we so removed from the experience, the raw sensory experience of being in the natural world, that we don't even know what that is anymore? I wonder about that. Mm. My daughter is 1 year old, and I think about that a lot for her and her future and what's it going to be like for her. I'm not anti-technology at all. I think it's an amazing tool, but I just don't know how to navigate through that whole sphere yet.
Well, and there's so much that we remember at whatever level, at a soul level, or what is taught to us by our parents, or what is carried through our ancestors. There's so much that we can remember, stories, ways of being, ways of connecting with the land. And yet very quickly, in just like a generation or a couple of generations, we've forgotten so much of that. And it's part of what's so powerful about your work here is that you are committed to remembering in that very deep way.
Mm. I do feel that way. I have said to my husband, you know, I would die for this. You know, there are causes or things that we really believe in, and there are a lot of those that I believe in, but this one, really important to me, this the need and the importance, to use that word again, of just lying face down in the grass or something, even if it's for a night. I had the idea the other day, you know, what if everyone in the world, or let's just say the U.S., decided that one night a year, one night, they would schlep their tents out or their sleeping bags or their blankets, whatever they have, and just sleep outside one night, even if it's on your porch if you live in a city, something like that. What would that do? I really wonder, because we would sort of tap into our animal selves again and be asked to sort of be paying attention in a way that we don't normally have to.
That's a wonderful idea, and I wonder how many people would make themselves vulnerable in that way. As I hear you saying that, I'm already thinking of the reasons I couldn't do that. Well, yes, that's a great idea, but I'm already thinking of the 10 reasons why that would not work for me, right?
Of course. I mean, yeah. And I like that honesty, because I think we all have that. You know, it's very easy to make those choices or to decide why something might not work or... And it's scary, you know, we've been so removed from nature for so long that it's scary. And it is anyway, even if you are in it, you know, you're small in it. You're just one little fleck of a whole big ecosystem.
Hmm. Will you share with us, will you pull something from the book and read to us?
Yes, I would love to. This is about halfway through the book, and it speaks for itself. I was trying to have a conversation with the land, with its hawthorns, its animals, and now its ice. Ice layered over the creek in long, pale blue sections, like catwalks. Deer had begun to use these passageways to get across, leaving their delicate tracks in the snow skim. An artist friend told me that if you really want to know a place, you must draw it. More importantly, you must draw what you see, not what you think you see. It was a confusing demand to draw what I saw versus what I wanted to see. We all wanted to see what we wanted to see, which in turn would become what we thought we saw, right? How could you pry yourself away from that impulse? It seemed that when you glared at something hard enough, you eventually burrowed your way through to the other side, where that thing becomes not what it is supposed to be, but what it is for you. I stared at the blue ice and saw everything but blue ice. There was the lace on my fold-over socks when I was 6 and living in Spain, or a whale's baleen from a Baltimore museum, or the ice cubes I used to suck on after school, or the slit of a vagina that symbolizes, well, everything, or a basket of sand dollars I touched in a tourist shop and felt sorry for, or adipose tissue beneath my microscope in 7th grade, or bubbles my brothers and I blew in the pool on scorching days, or striped wallpaper from a house we never moved into, or the gap between being 29 and being 30. And quickly, the shapes I saw told the story of my past. But no drawing happened on my paper. I moved toward the ice and pressed my ear down.
Oh, that's tremendously powerful. And that idea of moving past what you think you see, think you know, think you hear, into what you really see, know, hear, feel, is enormous. As you created this book, what do you want to do with this? What do you want us to take from this? How can people who are feeling lost or rootless or running away, how can we use this book as our map to help us reconnect?
You know, I don't think it has to be so dramatic. I would never say, oh, everyone needs to move somewhere and build a yurt. Obviously, that isn't my campaign, yurts for everyone. But I do think that it would be really simple. You know, I would say to someone, you know, where are you right now? Look around. You know, step outside. You know, step outside of your apartment or your house. What is around you? Step into it. What is the sensory experience you're having? What are the sounds? What are the smells? Go somewhere where you can really have that sort of heightened experience of whatever it is that you're surrounded by. Because there's nature in everything, in every place, even in the biggest cities. And sit there for a second and just sit there, actually for longer than a second. And you don't have to do anything fancy, but just be in it and absorb it. And also ask a question of it. Walk up to a tree, as sort of silly as it sounds, walk up to a tree and ask it a question, and you will receive an answer. And I don't mean it will speak to you. I mean you will see something in the bark that you already know that you weren't able to access in yourself, and it will be there, and it will present itself to you. And wow, draw on that amazing, amazing power and gift that is out there and available to us that we just don't access. Because we're distracted. So I would say just it's starting simply and just pausing, quieting, and allowing nature to sort of fill those gaps and sort of speak to you about yourself. That really is my takeaway from my experience wasn't necessarily that, oh, I found the perfect home and now all my questions are answered. That's part of it, but it's not the easy pat ending that people might expect. It's more that, wow, regardless of what is surrounding me, whether I live in New York City or Beijing or Iceland or Montana, I need to be able to access that internal space of calm and peace. And I think living on the land really introduced me to that. I needed, that was my The land was my teacher in that way. Introduced me to, oh, here's the space within you. And for me, I visualize it as a dome in my ribcage. This is the space within you that that you have. No one can take it away from you. No one can destroy it. It's there. Go there. You know, that's really my learning that I would offer to other people.
And that idea that when I, let's see, about 5 years ago, we moved across the country. And it was a move that I made grudgingly and with crankiness and bitterness. And I got to the place where I live now, and I spent about the first 2 years, my relationship with the place, the physical place, every tree, every leaf, every building made me angry because I was not where I wanted to be. And I didn't embrace the place, and I wouldn't lie face down in the grass if you paid me. And I was going to show the place how angry, I don't know what I thought would happen, but I basically had a temper tantrum for a couple of years. And what happened as I then settled into this place, what happened was that the place rose up to meet me, to support me, to nurture me, right? That whether or not I acknowledged it, I was here. And I can connect from wherever I happen to be, but sometimes we fight our places so much.
Yeah.
That it's hard to hear that message. It would have been hard for me to look at the bark of the tree and see something other than stupid tree. What are you doing here? You're not where I want you to be. Because we project our own experience onto our surroundings, I think.
Yeah, and that's, I love how you say all of that. Because I felt that in many instances as well. But the way you described it is that eventually the place came to meet you, you know, and some part of you, it sounds like, opened enough that the place sort of crawled in there and said, hey, I'm here. And then the connection was born. But I don't mean to sort of romanticize or gloss over the challenge of for people, especially who are in a place that they don't want to be in. That can feel very stifling. And, you know, for some people, the answer absolutely is to get out of there. I would never, you know, absolutely. But there's so much, we have so, not everyone, but there are so many opportunities to just change. Your job, your partner, over and over again, your place. And I wonder about that. I wonder if that's always the best choice.
Well, we changed the externals, right? How would this look if I wore a different shirt? Well, exactly the same,
exactly.
Except I'm wearing a different shirt, right?
Right. And I talk about that. You know, my father and I laugh because we're very similar, and I watched him. My whole life, we would move to a new place, and suddenly he had sort of a new outfit for the new place and a new car for the new place. And for him, that was really a remaking. It was very energizing, and it was fun. And my brothers and I would, I think I read in a book, we would sort of splash around in that light of, ooh, what's the new thing? So fun. Even thinking about it, it sort of makes my, my chest sort of tingle a little bit. But there's an emptiness there. There's a lack of something is what it feels like. And my father and I have talked about that. It's just a filling of a hole. And that's been my case my whole life. And I still do that on a lot of levels. But I'm just trying to be aware of it and sort of witness myself. Say, whoa. Why do I think that, traveling to this place is going to solve this feeling I'm having?
You may or may not be on Pinterest, but I recently discovered it and started a board on Pinterest called, I don't know, like Dream Travel or whatever. And I found all these beautiful pictures of, you know, temples in the sunset and beachscapes and city lights and all of this. And sometimes looking at that takes me to a beautiful imaginative place. And sometimes looking at what I've collected there makes me feel like I just ate 1,000 French fries when I didn't really want a French fry at all. Do you know what I mean? That awful, that greasy, metallic, awful, what have I just done? And there's that, we get to those places where the external doesn't serve us in the way that we thought it would.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's just it. And yeah, it's constant. I'm in a whole new phase now of being a mom and going through the first year of my child's life. And that has thrown me for the most amazing and challenging loop ever in my life. And there are many things that I've wanted that are external. You know, I need a room for her so that she can have her own space. Ah, otherwise I can't be calm, you know, or I need, I don't know, things that I know 5 years from now will seem ridiculous, but in the moment they feel so urgent. And, it's really hard in that moment to sort of pause and say, whoa, hold on, we're fine. Actually, all we really need is each other and our connection here. But there's always the longing. And I don't think the longing is bad, actually. I think seeking, I will always be a seeker. And most people I know are seekers. And I think that's what keeps us alive and keeps us engaged and curious about the world. I am not... If I ever meet someone who sort of doesn't seem like they're seeking anything ever, I always sort of look at them like, I don't know you. I don't know what kind of creature you are. I'm a different kind of creature. What kind of creature are you? And I'm sort of in awe of that person and sort of unclear on how they operate. So I don't think seeking is bad, but I guess it's how we channel our seeking.
Hmm. It's that wanting that rises up, and sometimes we're not clear on what is it that we really want. When I feel that wanting well up in me, is what I really want is the 1,000 French fries, or maybe is what I'm really wanting, what's underneath that is to know that I am safe, or know that I am fed, or know that I am whole. So maybe it's about how we connect to what the real want is.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And that's hard to connect to, I think.
It's a practice. Absolutely. I think it can't, whether you live in a yurt or if I go out in my backyard and try to, with love, look at the birds at the bird feeder, right? It's that practice, every breath, a little bit, every day, the redirecting of those wants.
I was going to say that the practice, that's another thing about the book and the living. I did spend every day sort of meditating in my internal dome. And that was a really important part of my sort of settling into myself. Since having a child, I have had less time to do that. And I've felt the sort of wavy disorientation of not having that time and that space. And so when you say practice, you really nailed something there of it really is an everyday going within, regardless of what's happening.
Molly, what is next for you? I know that you teach and now you're raising your beautiful young daughter. Will there be more books? May I have more, please?
Yes. I do teach classes and still doing that, and that brings me real joy to sit with people with their own stories. So I'll continue doing that, and I am working on my second book in very rough, raw first draft form, and I don't know exactly what it's about. I probably won't until I've written 3/4 of it, but it is exploring emotional inheritance through sort of a matrilineal lineage. I'm living near my mother while raising my daughter. I thought my daughter was going to be a boy, and she ended up being a girl. And so it's brought up all sorts of wild and emotional questions for me. And looking sort of at how we interact with our bodies, especially as women in landscape, but also just in general, what's that connection and what gets passed down. So those are the questions I'm asking, and we'll see what happens. But I'm excited about it. I feel... body and landscape are my two hot topics. That's what I want to explore.
That is wonderful. Thank you for being on the show today. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And thank you for the gift of your book. This is powerful stuff. And thank you so much for sharing and being on the show today.
Of course. Thank you so much, Karen.
Thank you, Molly. That was Molly Caro May. Her new book is The Map of Enough. You can find that on Amazon.com. It's published by Counterpoint Press. You can reach Molly and read her blog. Find out more about her work at MollyCaroMay.com. That's MollyCaroMay.com. And of course, you can always connect with me to share your questions about the show if you'd like to connect with me privately. I'm open to that too. All the details are at KarenHager.com. And thank you for listening today. Together, we are spreading a little more light in the world, and a little more light is always a good thing. Until next time, I'm wishing you peace.